Well, you got your Jobs Day Fridays, and then you got your Jobs Day Fridays. 916,000 is the number of the day today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 2nd of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, how about that? 916,000 new jobs in this economy in March. Restaurants and hotels, education, construction, manufacturing. Honestly, I could just go on naming industries. They have all added jobs. We are down to an unemployment rate of 6% even, and that is with a whole bunch of people getting back into the labor force. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with the goods of this very good jobs report.
Positive comments were a dime a dozen as I did my economist calls today, starting with Nicole Golden at the Atlantic Council.
Definitely signs of a boom.
Very happy to see it.
What's got Michael Farron at the Mercatus Center pumped up is the trajectory. 233,000 jobs added in January, then 468,000 in February, and doubling again to more than 900,000 in March.
You think March's number is high, April and May's numbers are going to be positively eye-popping as larger and larger proportions of the population are vaccinated and more of the economy reopens.
The breadth of job growth is what impressed Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions. Not just hard-hit bars and restaurants, but retail, transportation, the building trades, finance.
A lot of businesses are looking ahead to really strong consumer demand, and they don't want to be caught flat-footed without the necessary employees.
Getting everyone back to work, especially unemployed parents, will require more rebound in services for those workers, says Nicole Golden at the Atlantic Council.
We need childcare to come back because it employs a lot of women, and in particular minority women. And because the burden of care and school closures have pushed so many millions of women out of the labor force.
Childcare jobs are still 15% below pre-pandemic levels. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now, you cannot just have an economy add almost a million jobs in a month and let poor Mitchell Hartman do all the heavy lifting. So, Neela Richardson is at ADP, Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider, and we've got 6.5 minutes to figure out what's what with that jobs report and this economy. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you. And Mitchell gave the goods, as I said, on that very good jobs report. Just in the interest of context, what were you maybe not so wild about?
Yeah, I'm happy to be the dark cloud behind the silver lining of this really positive and encouraging report. But there are some telltale signs that there will be some more permanent scarring in the labor market. Let's start with the long-term unemployed. Mm-hmm. A year ago, we thought that the lion's share of this deep job loss would be temporary, temporary layoffs, temporary unemployment. But now we're seeing that that number of long-term unemployed, people who have been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, has climbed every month since April of last year, going from 4% of those who are unemployed all the way up to over 43% in this report. And that is concerning because the longer you are out of the labor market, the harder it is to get back in. It's also concerning because younger people have been affected by this pandemic. And we know that if you start off slow in terms of your entry into the jobs market, it carries through for several years into your career. So a couple of dimensions that really cause some concern.
Lynette, let me ask you just on that thing about long term. You know, we gained a million jobs this month, but we keep going at this rate. We've still got like a year to go, man, before we get everything back.
Absolutely. And let me premise this by saying USA, USA. But we have 2 million women who are gone from the labor force. Yep. We have to keep this trajectory going, which 900,000 jobs, that's an eye-popping number. I've been covering the economy for 10 years. I've, you know, that's something that definitely stands out to me. But it is a huge rate and we have to keep it going. We have 8.5 million jobs to get back still. So heave ho, everyone. And you know, the president talked about this today, actually, in a few remarks about his infrastructure bill and about the jobs report, which is that, you know, the Recovery Act was just that. It was a recovery act. It was a rescue, or it was a rescue plan. The Recovery Act is supposed to help people who are in some of these tougher positions because they've been out of the labor market so long to get jobs that are good paying jobs. Black unemployment, for example, is still at 10%. And we know that Biden's infrastructure bill, the Recovery Act, whatever we end up calling it as a nation, is going to focus on minority communities and underserved communities that have been hit harder during this pandemic. Yeah. So we still have a long way to go. The rescue plan ain't going to do it. But at the same time, you can do Mighty Mouse arms on either side for this jobs report.
Consider them done. I think technically it's the American Jobs Plan is the latest thing out of the White House. But Neela, let me ask you about that, because when the president came out this week and talked about his big infrastructure plan, $2 trillion, he really leaned into the idea that he wants to change this economy. He literally said, we are not tinkering around the edges. Talk to me for a minute about the really huge change we seem to be seeing in the government's role in this economy.
Well, there's a reason why the past three presidents have thrown their support behind an infrastructure plan. Sometimes without avail, because the trick with infrastructure is you have to pay for it now for gains in the future. And that's exactly what the issue is. Because if you look past this year, which we think will be high in terms of the economic growth rate, later years show a country that has tepid growth. We're talking 2% or below years out. And what an infrastructure plan now can do is increase the productive capacity of the economy into the future. So we won't see under 2%. We'll hopefully see back up around 3% to keep up with inflation, population growth. So that is the promise of infrastructure, but that promise pays off into the future, which is why the politics of today make it hard to accomplish.
Right, right. So, hey, Neela, Lynette, let me ask you about that inflation and growth into the future and the fact that we're still missing 8.5 million jobs. Mary Daly, the president of the San Francisco Fed, said this week, and Jay Powell has said ad infinitum, we are going to stay accommodative. We're going to keep interest rates low until we're all the way back. There's nothing in today's jobs report that makes you say, oh, man, the Fed's going to raise rates, right?
No, the Fed, we're digging ourselves out of a hole. Yeah. Deflation is our problem. We haven't seen inflation on the face of the planet in a real meaningful way since the financial crisis. This is kind of something that people on Wall Street freak out about, that I don't think regular people need to concern themselves with so much.
Fair enough. All right, Neela, super quick question, and I'm going around with all our Friday regulars, and I think this is week three I'm doing it. It's a gut question, and I think the jobs report today makes it easier. We've turned a corner, right? I mean, we're on the downhill slide of this thing. Ooh,
we've turned the corner. Holy cow. I'm sorry. I know that's wrong for radio, but yes, we've turned the corner. We're seeing a recovery, but let's not kid ourselves. This is a recovery. This is not new jobs. And you asked me about structural changes in the economy, and I'm seeing that in the jobs market. I'm worried about the idea of flexible employment, that economies can expand and shrink their labor force at will coming out of this pandemic. I'm worried about structural changes in automation of certain jobs that have been pulled forward because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried about the affected groups. So when we talk about the new economy, this is going to be a digital forward economy. And we need to make sure that the jobs that we lost, when we bring them back, they can be less vulnerable to a downturn and more ready to be sustainable into the new economy.
Yeah, makes sense. Lynette, super quick, same question. Turn the corner, you buy it or not?
I definitely buy it. We've turned the corner. But again, yeah, the problems we had before the pandemic still exist. And I think that that's what Biden's new plan is trying to address.
Yeah. Lynette Lopez, she's at Business Insider. Neela Richardson, she's at ADP. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a good one, Kai.
You too. We'll talk soon. On Wall Street today, I'll tell you what, it was an interesting day for traders to be off for Good Friday. The calendar can be funny sometimes. We will think of something to say when we do the numbers. Okay, totally different topic. One of the many, many ways the pandemic has changed this economy is in the sharp growth of peer-to-peer payment apps. Venmo may be the best known, but there are others that let you pay friends or buy things digitally. You just transfer the money. One of the reasons those P2P payments have been thriving is that a whole lot of new businesses have launched during this pandemic. Businesses that often started out as side hustles, maybe, and that have come to rely on P2P apps just to get paid. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
For about 9 years, Ashley France has been doing spray tans in Annapolis, Maryland, mostly as a hobby for friends and family and the cheerleaders she used to coach before the pandemic.
But never really as like a business venture.
When COVID hit, Fran suddenly had a lot of free time. So she decided maybe it could be a business venture.
I just kind of felt like, what better time than now?
In April, Fran created Sunburst Tans to offer tans in people's homes. She says for her customers, keeping contact to a minimum is important, including when they pay her. So many of them prefer Venmo, PayPal, and Zelle.
That's one of my frequently asked questions is, you know, how do you accept payment? So I'm happy to be able to offer that.
In the early stages of the pandemic, according to census data, the number of new business applications doubled.
Basically, because, you know, people home out of work get creative about how to generate some cash.
That's analyst Lisa Ellis with the research outfit Moffitt Nathanson. She says the growth of those businesses has really helped P2P apps grow, too.
Maybe the independent fitness instructor or babysitter or dog walker, you know, which drive a large amount of the volume over these services.
Business owners like P2P apps because they're seen as a safer way to handle payments these days. Felipe Chacon is an economist with the payments company Square. He says industries that have shifted away from cash the fastest have been the ones hit hardest by the pandemic. Restaurants, health and fitness, and the beauty industry.
In the beauty and personal care sector, we see that the share of cashless businesses nearly doubled with them as well, jumping from 11% pre-pandemic to around 20% now.
As more businesses started using P2P apps, they started paying each other with them too.
Everyone has kind of quickly adopted it.
That's Jess Harrington in Boston. In January of 2020, she started Jess Finest, a company that helps real estate agents prepare homes to go to market.
We may do some redesign, we may rearrange furniture, and then for a lot of new builds and condos, we fully outfit the home with new furniture.
She uses P2P apps to pay for all of the services involved in staging a home for sale. Her husband, Justin, does the bookkeeping.
We're paying out to movers, contractors, painters,
photographers, electrician.
Yeah.
Jess Harrington says there's another upside to P2P apps. As soon as her clients pay her with one, she can spend that money right away instead of waiting a few days for a credit card transaction to clear.
So the more kind of immediate cash that I have through Venmo, primarily, I'd say, just the easier it is for me to move quick and do business.
And she's been doing a lot of business, she says, ever since the real estate market started exploding last year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The bloom is off that rose.
Airlines, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Stock markets are closed today in observance of Good Friday. As I said, for the 5 days gone by, Dow Industrials up 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 2.6%, closed above 4,000 for the first time. S&P 500 added 0.1%. With more people now vaccinated, the open road may be beckoning. Sales of new cars, actually new vehicles, which is cars and light trucks, jumped to 17.75 million in March. That is an increase of 56%. From the same month last year. Bond markets closed early today. I don't know why bond traders have to work, but stock traders don't. Anyway, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year up to 1.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was word today from Major League Baseball that it is moving this year's All-Star Game out of Atlanta. That's in response to the new law in Georgia that, as you might have heard, adds new requirements for absentee voting and limits ballot drop boxes, gives a lot more power over elections to the state legislature, all changes that will disproportionately affect black voters. And it's not just Georgia. Other states are considering similar laws as well. And corporate America, after being mostly silent, to be honest, is beginning to speak up, most notably in the form of a letter signed by 70 black executives and led by Ken Frazier and Ken Chenaults, two of only 19 black CEOs ever to lead Fortune 500 companies. Ken Frazier is the CEO of Merck. Ken Chenault used to run American Express, and I got him on the phone earlier today. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on. And Mr. Chenault, let me start with you, sir, and ask you this question. You have said in the past week, as this letter and the thing that you and Mr. Frazier are trying to get done has become public, you have said it is time for actions, not statements. What does that look like to you?
What it looks like, and I think this is very important, is one, what we want companies to do is to publicly oppose legislation that discriminates against voters and legislation that hinders them from being able to vote. And so it's very important that companies not just issue a broad statement, but in fact to oppose any legislation that hinders people from voting.
So, Ms. Frazier, let me take a twist on that and point out that the Georgia law is already signed. It is a done deal. It is law in the state of Georgia. Companies down there, and in fact, you two were both reasonably quiet during the period the law was being debated. Has the horse already left the barn, as it were?
I don't believe so. I think it's important to recognize that laws like this are being proposed in 43 states around the country. And, you know, while the law is passed, you know, there's always an opportunity if people of good faith want to think about these kinds of things to improve that law. So I think it's important before this whole set of laws gets ginned up around the country for all people, including corporate people, to make sure that they understand that this really will impede the right of voters to vote.
Mr. Chenault, in the last couple of days, a lot of CEOs, especially ones in Atlanta and in Georgia, have spoken up as you and Mr. Frazier have gotten more publicity for your work. And I'm thinking here of the CEO of Coca-Cola, also Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta Airlines. What do you make of the move in the Georgia House? It did not become law, but what do you make of the move there to repeal a big tax break for Delta on jet fuel in apparent retribution for Mr. Bastian's comments opposing this law?
I think it's very unfortunate. If people express their opinion, there should not be retribution. And it frankly does not help the economy of Georgia. And fortunately, it did not pass.
Mr. Chenault, do you think you're having a moment here? I mean, is this a ripe opportunity to redress a generations-long issue in American business?
I hope so. And I think what's absolutely critical here, and we keep on coming back to this, is the right to vote is a fundamental right. But with respect to Black Americans, the path to the right to vote was very tortuous. And one of the points that I make is just think after Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, if companies said, we're now also going to integrate our workforces. And so I think there is an opportunity for companies to stand up. And one of the things that Ken and I emphasize, this is a nonpartisan issue. And what I hope is that more companies will understand that there is nothing more fundamental than the right to vote, and they need to stand up for America and Americans.
Mr. Frazier, last word to you, sir, and it's pretty simple. Now what?
As Ken just said, this is a fundamental issue for our democracy. And I'm hoping that we will get many allies who will stand up and will make sure that the public understands really what's at stake for all voters here for the legitimacy of our way of governing ourselves. And I think it's also important for us to recognize that if we're going to make changes in the name of ballot security, which is a valid, valid thing, we have to balance it by not having undue restrictions on ballot access.
You know, so I said that was the last question, and I meant it to be, but it's not, because you've brought up the fundamental point here, right? And Mr. Chenault, let me direct this question to you. What's at issue here is the big lie about the 2020 election. And I wonder how you now corral corporate America, where you two have a lot of sway, to fight the political fight that is the fight against the big lie that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, while at the same time remembering that those companies, of which you two ran big ones, have to deal with customers and their whims and making money.
I think what's very important here, and I think it's the way I've always tried to lead my life and to lead American Express when I was CEO, and I know Ken feels the same way. You need to be governed by a strong moral code. And what we cannot do is be silent. To the point you made earlier, there has been no evidence of widespread fraud. And this is a very important moment for our democracy, and corporations must take a stand.
Ken Chenault used to run American Express. Ken Frazier runs Merck for another couple of months, retiring this summer. Gentlemen, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking to us.
Air travel, as we update you on every now and then with those TSA numbers that I love so much, continues its long, slow climb back to normal. Well over a million people a day getting on planes now. That is aviation data point number one. Data point number two comes from the Centers for Disease Control, which said today, among other things, that people who are fully vaccinated are less likely to get and spread COVID. And so, timestamp here, one might reasonably expect a spring and summer travel boom. Data point number two. But it's been a while since airlines have had to have that kind of capacity to deal with the boom. Marketplace's Erica Barris has more now on why hiring pilots in particular is going to be tricky.
Airlines say they'll have to hire thousands of pilots, but those pilots may not be in the pipeline. Airlines used to recruit a lot from the military, says travel industry analyst Henry Hartevelt. But after years of airline bankruptcies and mergers,
the military pilots looked at the airlines and said, you know, the bloom is off that rose. I'm going to stay in the military and complete my career as a pilot here.
And says airline industry analyst Robert Mann, airline pilots moving closer to retirement age just went for it when the pandemic hit.
Their companies made it either an economic imperative or an economic opportunity to retire early.
About 1,000 pilots retired from United Airlines alone since September. Yesterday, United told employees it was hiring 300 pilots immediately. It's not easy or affordable to become a pilot, says Faye Malarkey Black with the Regional Airline Association.
This career path, unfortunately, has historically very much been set aside for the elite. Families that have either private wealth or access to private capital.
Training, logging hours of flight time, paying for insurance. Faye Malarkey Black says student loans don't cover those extras, so they're often out of reach for lower-income students, including those of color. 3% of commercial pilots are Black. To help fix that, she says the airline industry needs to pick up with training programs that paused in the pandemic. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that even the most viral of news stories can have real-world impact. As you know, the Ever Given has been unstuck, and the 10 to 12% of global trade that passes through the Suez Canal is flowing once again. But all those ships that were backed up and waiting are now going to show up at various European ports at more or less the same time. I saw this in the Financial Times today, a story about shipping companies desperately trying to negotiate for slots at those ports so they can offload. What's happening now is a messy situation, one scheduler said. Now the ketchup bottle has been opened, the negotiations start. Nobody ever said global trade was pretty. All right, we are going, but here is your end of the week moment of economic context. Still, and again, in keeping with the policy of this program, that if we stop talking about this stuff, we're going to stop talking about this stuff. The overall unemployment rate, as Mitchell was telling us, fell to 6% even last month for Black Americans. Lynette mentioned this, I think, did not budge. 9.6% unemployment for Black Americans. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassid is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.